journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass
descent. These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Monday, December 17th, 2007, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
Ecuador announces its eviction of a U.S. airbase. New Jersey moves to ban the death penalty, and the United States derails change at the Bali conference, plus a commentary by Mumia Abu-Jamal on the concept of a black president. But I can't help
myself, why should I? This is Uprising.
Good morning and welcome to Uprising. Last week, the New Jersey State Legislature voted to pave the way for the state to become the first in four decades to repeal the death penalty. Governor John Corzine, long in favor of abolishing capital punishment, is expected to sign into law the replacement of the death sentence with life without parole next month. Opponents of capital punishment view the recent vote as just the latest indicator that the U.S. public is beginning to turn away from the death penalty. As the number of death sentences and executions continues to reduce nationwide, anti-death penalty activists hope that other states follow New Jersey's suit. But currently, 36 states make use of the death penalty as a form of punishment, and activists are quick to caution that a nationwide ban is not foreseeable in the immediate future. My guest is Lance Lindsay. He is the executive director of Death Penalty Focus, and he joins us on the line this morning. Welcome to Uprising, Lance.
Good morning.
Good morning, and thanks so much for joining us.
Sure.
So let's talk about New Jersey in particular first. Is this a victory that death penalty opponents like yourself expected? How long was it in the making?
Well, activists and advocates to end the death penalty have been working on this for a very, very long time in New Jersey. And not only the activists within New Jersey, the whole national abolition movement has been focused on this state because we felt that there was an opportunity here to show the rest of America that the death penalty is no longer a third rail in politics, that in fact it's a majority position globally. The practice of executing prisoners is a marginal minority practice around the world. Majority of nations don't execute their prisoners. And in fact, majority of states in the United States don't practice the death penalty. It happens really in a handful of southern states. So
now, they don't practice it, but it is available on the books as a form of punishment.
Oh, yes, it certainly is available, but it's just not being used. So out of principle or out of practice or law, it's just not being used globally as much as it used to be. And it's something that I think Americans are looking at critically, and whether they oppose it for moral reason or oppose it because it's just unfair and unjust and too many innocent people caught up in it or it's racist, they're abandoning the practice of killing prisoners.
So why is it that it's taken so long then to get it banned in just even one state? You know, why is there so much resistance to it in state governments in particular?
Well, I think it's because, politicians use it. You know, the death penalty really is a political tool. It's not a public safety tool. In fact, where they execute the most frequently in the South, they have the highest rate of violent crime and homicide. So it's not doesn't make us safer, but politicians like to use it as a way to say that vote for me and we're tough on crime. They, they appeal to fears in public when reports about violent crime on television, you know, becomes prevalent, then they're right. They're the very first people to say, listen, I have the solution, and it's killing more prisoners. Of course, it's not a solution, and as a matter of fact, recently, police chiefs in this nation said it's the least effective deterrent. Solving drug abuse problems, gun violence, those poverty, those kinds of things cause more crime. than not executing.
I remember it was just a little over 2 years ago that very high-profile prisoner Stanley Tookie Williams, a Nobel Peace nominee, was executed by the state of California, much to the dismay of many death penalty opponents and just in general people of conscience throughout the world and the U.S. Certainly, it seems as though states like California and Texas do make use of the death penalty more often than other states. Here in California, what sort of movement is there, if any, along the lines of New Jersey?
Well, there's lots of work going on here in California. And by the way, in California, we've had 13 executions. Texas has had some 400, 500 executions. Like I say, 90% of all executions happen in the South from Texas to Florida. Yes, in 2005, Tookie Williams was executed. And, of course, political leaders here want to bring him back. But there's lots of activism in the state. There's a commission that's in place right now that's been in place for the last year looking at wrongful convictions and flaws in our justice system, and now they're going to zero in on the death penalty. They're having commission meetings, hearings in January and February and March. The public's welcome to attend those. They can come to our website at deathpenalty.org and find out the dates and the places for those commission hearings. There's lots of activism in the religious community right now. And public support in California is dropping, too. They pointed in New Jersey that, in fact, there's a preference for life without parole over death, the public believing now that life without parole means that as an alternative to death. And the same in California. If you ask the public, are they for or against the death penalty in California, you'll get the 64% say they do, which is a huge drop. 10 years ago, it was 85%. So support for the death penalty is low, but if you ask them, would you prefer life without parole over death as the ultimate sanction, there's a preference for life without parole. So public interest and support for the death penalty is dropping. Looking at alternatives is rising. You know, we have political leaders, whether it be the mayor of L.A. or whether the mayor of San Francisco. We have our own Kamala Harris in San Francisco, a district attorney. All of these folks, major political leaders, oppose the death penalty. So the activism will continue as political courage and leadership begins to grow, similar to what happened in New Jersey.
Now, what role, Lance, has the exposing of the flaws of the death penalty played in this national dialogue, particularly given how many inmates across the country are being exonerated by DNA evidence?
Yes, I think the bright light that's been shown on the death penalty in recent years has called into question in the public's mind about whether the death penalty is fair, whether it's serving a public safety interest, or whether or not it's just singling out a particular class of individuals. You know, 1% of all homicides end up as death sentences. That's 1%. But that 1% is basically made up of folks that are minorities, or made up of people that are mentally ill, people that can't afford lawyers. And it's race, place, and poverty that decide who gets sentenced to death and who doesn't, not the nature of the crime. And so this light on the flaws and failures of our criminal justice system, and especially how the death penalty is administered, has created tremendous doubt in the public's mind and has led to the softening of support for the death penalty. Over 120 individuals have been released from America's death row, found exonerated, found to be innocent. That's just intolerable that we have so many people who are innocent within hours of being executed.
Now, what role has the Supreme Court and its decisions made in paving the way for the ban in New Jersey?
Well, in New Jersey, it was really a matter of political leadership and public support. They held their commission as well, showing that that the system was unfair and too costly and too expensive. That also helped lower public support. But now the Supreme Court is looking at the constitutionality of the lethal injection process. That we're looking at it here in California. We're looking, the U.S. Supreme Court is looking at it effectively.
And is that a result of the Morales case?
Yes, the Morales case raised the issue of the unconstitutionality of lethal injection. And the court here in California, a district judge halted executions while they examined the protocol process, and now the U.S. Supreme Court is doing the same. So states, and, you know, it's not just New Jersey, Colorado, Montana, New Mexico. All these states came within just a handful of votes of abolishing the death penalty. In New Hampshire, they did vote it out, but the governor vetoed that bill. So this move to abolish the death penalty is realistic. It's hopeful. It's not, you know, pie in the sky, as some of us were told 10, 20 years ago. Hmm. It's a real movement whose time has come.
Hmm. I want to remind our listeners I'm speaking with Lance Lindsay. He is the executive director of Death Penalty Focus. We're talking about the fact that New Jersey has recently banned the death penalty. However, New Jersey had last made use of the death penalty in 1963, so it certainly is quite a symbolic victory, not just a practical one. Now, what do you expect in terms of the aftermath of New Jersey? Which states do you think are the most likely to follow suit? Do you think California, with these hearings that you mentioned that are going to be taking place in January and February of next year, is the most likely next candidate?
Well, it's hard to say. You know, these things can come and surprise us, especially as the twists and turns of political movements and leadership come and go. But likely, Maryland is now looking very closely at their death penalty, and there's some hope that could be changed there. I'm certain the other states that came close, some states like Colorado, Montana, coming within just a handful of votes of abolishing it there. These states are not the most considered the most liberal states in the nation. Not even New Jersey is really considered that, and yet there's political leadership and political will. You know, New Jersey hadn't executed anybody since the 60s. They had eight men on death row there, and even though the public poll showed that some 57 or 58% of the public supports the death penalty, there was no will to execute. And I think that's really what's happening here in California. Public polls show that the electorate's in favor of the death penalty here, but there's no will to execute because they know the system has got it wrong. They know that there's too much error, and there's too much racism, there's too much unfairness in the system. Hmm. So California may be, you know, a couple of years away, depending on the shift in political leadership in the next year or two, really. But other states, from New Mexico to Maryland to Colorado, Montana, I think they're going to bring those efforts back to abolish the death penalty, and we may be surprised next year and the years to come.
And I just want to clarify what I said earlier about New Jersey, that the state has voted to replace the death penalty with life without parole. The assembly has also passed it, and it's just basically a bill that's being that's going to be signed very likely into law by the governor, who very much favors the ban on death penalty. It's not official yet, but very much about to be official.
He has yet to sign the bill, but we're expecting him to do it this week.
Right. And just briefly speaking about California, what is Governor Schwarzenegger's position on the death penalty?
Well, Governor Schwarzenegger says that it's what he's doing, what the will of the people is. He's also made comments to the effect that, well, as a European, when he puts his European hat on, he's opposed to the death penalty. As you know, every European nation,
right,
every Western democracy opposes the death penalty. And when he puts his U.S. hat on, then he's for the death penalty because it represents what the public wants. So he's just playing political games like many political leaders play political games. It's a political calculation. It's not about what makes us safer. It's not about reforming our criminal justice system so we're investing money in things in the front end, in preventative programs that would really make us safer, whether it be more police on the street or better crime labs for better DNA detection. You know, in Santa Clara recently, they've had to abandon their cold case unit because they just run out of money. We have a state that is $14 billion in debt, and yet we want to spend tens of millions of dollars on executing a handful of men or women convicted of homicide. So it just really doesn't make sense from a cost-benefit analysis.
Right.
It doesn't make sense for moral analysis. It doesn't make sense in any which way except for political agenda is being met. And I think Governor Schwarzenegger is playing a political game like many political leaders do.
Well, speaking of political leaders, let's talk about the federal level with the presidential elections coming up next year. All of the Republican presidential candidates, I believe with the exception of Ron Paul, support the death penalty. Where the Democrats are concerned, the three top candidates, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and John Edwards, all support the death penalty. It does not look like on the federal level, depending on who, of course, gets elected, but it doesn't look like on the federal level there will be necessarily much movement against the death penalty?
Well, no. I mean, a lot of this we have to recognize is going to be an attempt at incremental justice. We're going to have to look to some political leaders who may be more center-left and center-right, who are not as rabid or not as aggressive on this issue. I think really Obama, though he has said he thinks it may need to be reserved for the most heinous of crimes or for terrorists, I think that's, again, more political recognition that to get elected in this country, you've got to show, you got to tip your hat a wee bit to the death penalty. But honestly, he comes from a state that went through a self-analysis about this issue, saw the flaws and failures in it. He's spoken to his has serious concerns about how the death penalty is applied, and he has supported moratorium in his state. He has supported the idea that we ought to look at it to make sure it's fair.
And the moratorium in Illinois still continues, right?
It still continues, mm-hmm. And it's still not executed 8 years now. So at least to have someone who's willing to say, I'm willing to question the system. You know, that's all we're asking at this point for those people who think the death penalty is a solution to anything, is to ask them to question it, to really look at it and how it's applied if they're not offended by it morally. And I think Barack Obama is one of those political leaders.
Well, Lance, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much for having me on.
Lance Lindsay is Executive Director of Death Penalty Focus, and his group's website is deathpenalty.org. And speaking of Barack Obama, later in the hour, we will be hearing a commentary from political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal about the concept of a black president. So definitely stay tuned for that. You are listening to Uprising, and near the end of our show, we'll hear about Ecuador's decision to evict an airbase that is currently leased to the United States, to evict the U.S. rather, from this airbase. And after this short break, we'll find out what has happened in the aftermath of the Bali Climate Change Conference. Stay tuned.
As I went walking that ribbon of highway.
KPFK listener sponsors, many of you are elders who have traveled KPFK's journey of change and challenge since 1959. We thank you for your generosity and loyalty. As veteran KPFK listener sponsors, this year only you can take advantage of a one-time opportunity to reduce your taxes while supporting KPFK. Under a temporary IRS rule, if you are 70 and a half years or older, you can donate up to $100,000 directly from your IRA to KPFK, and the good news is you will pay no income tax at all on your gift. However, you must complete your gift before December 31st of this year. If you qualify and want to take advantage of this opportunity, please call the Development Office at 818-985-2711, extension 214, and we will work with you to make it happen. And thank you for your long-term commitment to KPFK and our mission for peace and social justice. That's the Development Office, 818-985-2711, extension 214.
This land is yours. This land is my land.
Welcome back to Uprising. In the aftermath of the Bali Climate Conference, which world leaders are calling historic, the U.S. appears to have destroyed all hopes for international agreement on ending global warming. Even worse than the outcome of the Kyoto talks, 190 nations agreed that while something had to be done about the planet heating up, no targets or dates were set. In fact, all that was agreed upon was that further talks are needed over the next 2 years in order to come to agreement after the Kyoto Protocol expires in 2012. And of course, after 2 years, George W. Bush would be out of power. However, since the meetings in Kyoto 10 years ago, all countries have only increased their carbon emissions. While Europe was initially pushing for a specific goal of 25% to 40% cuts in carbon emissions in Bali, those numbers have now been relegated to a footnote in the final agreement. According to reports from attending delegates, U.S. negotiators remained obstructionist until the final hour of the two-week convention. They changed their position only after boos and hisses from other delegates. While international news media covered the conference in depth, most major U.S. news media barely touched the story. Meanwhile, the Senate passed the 2007 energy bill by a vote of 86-8. The bill increases automobile energy efficiency and promotes the use of ethanol, a so-called biofuel. Joining me on the line this morning is Tyson Slocum. He is the director of the energy program at Public Citizen. Welcome to Uprising, Tyson.
Hey, great to be here.
Thanks very much for joining us. I want to talk about the energy bill, but first, let's talk about Bali. We had talked with George Monbiot last week, who has written extensively about climate change. He is extremely disappointed by the outcome of Bali, which he says is even worse than what happened in Kyoto, because at least at Kyoto, there were some targets, however minimal, set. Do you agree?
Yeah, unfortunately, I do agree. I mean, the problem here is that all we've got is a general discussion that, hey, we need to do something, but we're not going to set any specific timetables or limits right now. And this all rests with the United States. The Bush administration, from the very beginning, has thumbed its nose at international cooperation on a number of issues. Most importantly here on climate change issues. And so I don't think that we're going to see any progress on global climate talks until we have a new administration in January 2009.
Hmm. Now, however, when we did have a Democrat in office during Kyoto under the Clinton administration, Al Gore, who went to Kyoto, also, you know, of course, wearing a different hat back then, was responsible for watering down the talks greatly, talking about emissions trading instead of real carbon emissions cutting, and people like George Monbiot are not as optimistic that even a new U.S. president would necessarily make a big difference.
I do think that there would be a difference. I mean, the Bush administration, up until very recently, dismissed the whole concept of climate change. Mm-hmm. And I think if you look at particularly the leading Democratic candidates, at least they recognize that we need to take aggressive actions. Are they going to go far enough? Probably not, but I don't think that there won't be any change between a Bush administration stance on the environment versus a Democratic president stance on the environment. Now, it is important to note that the president can't unilaterally enter the United States into this kind of agreement. It would have to be approved by the United States Senate. Now, we all remember that, you know, Clinton and Gore negotiated Kyoto, but the Senate rejected it by a vote of 100-0. So, and given the fact that the United States Senate was the big roadblock for comprehensive energy legislation, for domestic energy policy here in America, that is a very big challenge. And so we also have to focus on those senators that continue to roadblock effective U.S. energy policy, in addition to the roadblocks that the Bush administration has set internationally.
And I want to go to that energy bill in just a moment, but still on Bali, the U.S.'s excuses, if you will, for not doing anything on climate change is that it wants developing countries to do more, which is a sort of coded language for India and China in particular. The U.S. Is claiming that that it won't do anything unless those two countries take on more responsibilities. Well, how do you respond to that? Is that a legitimate desire at all?
Well, it is absolutely legitimate to ensure that China and India agree to some sort of binding emissions reductions the same way that the United States and Western Europe and other countries are. I mean, it won't make any difference to save the planet if America and Europe and other countries agree to significant emissions reductions while China builds a new coal-fired power plant every week and puts millions of new cars on the road. I mean, the fact is that this is a global problem, and we have to solve it cooperatively among all polluters.
But in the U.S., per capita emissions are much higher than in China.
Absolutely. Per capita, absolutely. But, you know, aggregate emissions in China are still extremely significant. Now, the question is, China is free to take a back seat. It's free to not take any initiative as long as the United States refuses to. Why on earth would a country like China agree to any binding reductions when the United States digs in its heels and claims that it shouldn't have to? So that's the problem, is only when the United States takes a leadership role will other nations follow. And I do think that we need to work on ways to mitigate the economic costs of adopting climate change policies to developing countries, but that shouldn't excuse China, India, or any other country from recognizing that this is a global problem and all countries must do more to reduce their emissions.
And Tyson, this was a large discussion in Bali, which was the cost of adapting to climate, to doing something about climate change for poor nations. Now, while there was a sort of vague commitment, I understand that no actual financial commitment was pledged until after 2012. And even then, money may be taken from existing development aid budgets to go toward doing something about climate change.
Right. I mean, there's no question that, you know, these timetables that folks are talking about implementing aren't going to go far enough. And, you know, a lot of this has to do with the roadblocks that that the Bush administration has put up. You know, from the very beginning, from the Cheney Energy Task Force report, it was clear that the Bush administration's agenda was promoting oil and coal and nuclear power. And that's what they've done consistently. And they are not about to give up their big campaign contributors to help protect the planet. And I think that the quicker that the United States recognizes the harmful interests of these special interests, like the big polluters that continue to dominate our debate, we're not going to make effective progress on getting the kind of global environmental treaty that that we desperately need.
It's interesting looking at the coverage of Bali, lots and lots of coverage internationally in the British press, in the Asian press, all over the world, very little in the U.S. I mean, certainly, you know, the New York Times had an in-depth article yesterday, but there's really not that much overall in the major U.S. media on a climate conference at which, you know, 190 countries were at the table and were considered to be absolutely historic. What do you think of this lack of media coverage?
Well, I think it's very unfortunate. And you know, some of it is because the president hasn't been using his bully pulpit. You know, American media, you know, we're used to being a little isolated here. Folks in the media sometimes just assume that America is happy to be an island and doesn't want to involve itself with the rest of the world. And that's helped by the fact that the president is not engaged on this. I mean, if we had a president that was making a major speech, exactly like you said, how historic this is that 190 countries have gotten together to try to put their heads together and work to solve climate change, you know, that would help get media coverage. You know, the quicker that we can move on from how destructive the Bush administration has been and move towards a new administration that I do think from the campaign literature, from the leading Democratic candidates, I do think that there would be radical departures. You know, I think that, you know, we in the environmental community are still going to have to push very hard on Democrats and others to make sure that they stick to their promises and do the right thing. But that said, I do see very radical differences between the head-in-the-sand approach of the Bush administration compared to the approach of the leading Democratic candidates, which is to engage the rest of the world and to get the United States to agree to binding reductions in greenhouse gas emissions.
My guest is Tyson Slocum. He is the director of the energy program at Public Citizen. We're talking about the aftermath of the Bali Climate Change Conference that just wrapped up after a couple of weeks in Bali, Indonesia. Let's talk about the related national story of the energy bill, that the 2007 energy bill that just passed the Senate by a vote of 86-8. Quite a large number of senators voting for this bill, which on the surface of this 1,000-page bill, so, you know, there's a lot of details, but on the surface, this bill looks like it will at least go in the right direction on things like automobile fuel efficiency. What is your assessment of this bill?
Well, first, it's a very big disappointment because this bill has been vastly watered down to what it looked like just a week ago. A week ago, there were two other historic parts of this energy bill that were chopped off when Republicans threatened to filibuster in the United States Senate. The first big thing that was removed from this bill at the last minute was the first ever federal mandate that all electric utilities would have to produce 15% of their energy from renewable energy like wind and solar by the year 2020. That would be huge. 27 states currently have similar mandates, and it would have been incredible to have a universal national standard to require the increased use of renewable energy. Second, the energy bill had a provision that would have repealed $13.5 billion worth of subsidies that are currently slated to go to oil companies like ExxonMobil. So taking away subsidies from big oil and shifting it into renewable energy and energy efficiency. That was rejected at the last minute when senators who have received $7 million in campaign contributions from big oil threatened to filibuster and had that provision removed. So is it a victory to increase our fuel economy standards to 35 miles a gallon? Absolutely. But it would have been so much better if these other provisions were in there. And it just really shows that big coal and big oil are still kings in Washington, D.C. And until we get to a system where we end this legalized bribery of special interests showering politicians with millions of dollars in campaign contributions, until we get a system of public financing, our democracy is going to continue to be for sale to these big polluters.
Now, was there also not a pretty serious part of the bill that promotes the use of ethanol as a so-called biofuel?
Right. There was a very big provision to vastly expand ethanol. And Public Citizen has some concerns about this. I mean, you know, ethanol is not the magic bullet to America's energy needs. Is it a little better than oil? Sure. But is it environmentally sustainable? No, it isn't. And I think that the level of financial support for ethanol is not warranted. We would rather see movement towards, you know, plug-in hybrids or things like that rather than, you know, electric cars rather than ethanol. I just don't think it's environmentally sustainable. And the massive cost of it really doesn't justify the level of support either.
Now, at Bali, the Brazilians were greatly pushing ethanol. This is a large part of their economic industry that they are hoping to push and get a world market for. Any connection, you think, between Bali, Brazil's push in Bali and the Senate's choice on this bill?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, Brazil has you know, had a fairly successful ethanol program making ethanol from sugarcane. But if you talk to a lot of activists on the ground in Brazil, you know, some of the working conditions in these sugarcane plantations that are producing this ethanol are terrible. I mean, people sometimes describe them as little better than slavery. And so there are huge labor concerns with the Brazilian sugarcane ethanol market. There's huge environmental concerns. Refining any sort of agricultural crop into a fuel is a very, very dirty process. You don't want to have a house or a school located near any sort of ethanol refinery. And there still are greenhouse gas emissions associated with it.
Right.
So Is it an improvement over just burning straight up petroleum? Of course. But we're not sure that this is the route that we should go. I don't think that turning cropland, shifting it from food production into fuel production, is really a healthy path for society to go towards. I think that we ought to be looking at non-agricultural fuel productions. We ought to be looking at the way that we consume fuel, because if we're just replacing gasoline in our tanks with ethanol, that's really not going to solve the problem. The problem is the miles driven per vehicle in the United States. It's the way that we've encouraged sprawl through our tax policies. We've got to get back to a more sustainable types of living and urban design that can accommodate the kind of population we have.
Finally, Tyson, does the bill also not phase out the use of the incandescent bulb in government institutions?
It does, and that's the old incandescent bulb that that Thomas Edison invented is very energy inefficient. Most of the energy is transformed into heat rather than into light. So moving towards alternatives like compact fluorescents are more advantageous. You know, one problem with a compact fluorescent light, I mean, I've got them in my home, but they contain a little bit of mercury, which is, of course, very toxic. So disposal of those light bulbs can be a very toxic thing, especially if consumers are not educated about proper disposal. We don't want to throw those kinds of light bulbs into a regular landfill. That could become very problematic from a toxic point of view.
That's a good point.
I don't mean to always have a caveat on all these things. We're definitely making progress. I think the bottom line is we should never be satisfied with it. We can always improve. Technologies are always improving. And we ought to be moving our public subsidies into those promising pollution-free technologies. The problem is that the vast majority of public subsidies in America continue to go to the coal and oil industries, and that's an outrage. Mm-hmm. And the fact that the oil industry was on the brink of getting billions of dollars in public subsidies taken away from them, and they stopped it, shows how powerful big oil is and how perverse the political situation in the U.S. Senate is, where a minority of senators can hold up effective energy policy on behalf of ExxonMobil. It is very tragic.
Tyson, what's Public Citizen's website?
Oh, sure. It's www.citizen.org.
That's citizen.org. Tyson Slocum, thank you so much for joining us today.
It was my pleasure.
That's citizen.org is the website for his organization, Public Citizen, where Tyson Slocum is the director of the energy program. You are listening to Uprising, and after a commentary by political prisoner and award-winning journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal, we'll find out why Ecuador has decided to evict the United States from a military base.
The idea of a black president. For much of the U.S. populace, the idea of a black president is one so new, so novel, that it forces many people to think of it as if it is barely possible, as if it is the stuff of fiction, not fact. Of course, time will tell if that is more than that. But for millions of people who share this land space we call North America, the idea is neither new nor groundbreaking. That's because there are some 100 million people in Mexico. In their country, had a black president some 178 years ago. It was during their war for independence from Spain when a warrior emerged who was a black Indian named Vicente Guerrero. In his first battle, he was commissioned a captain. As the independence war raged on, the leading revolutionaries either died or were captured. Guerrero fought on, leading 2,000 men into the Sierra Madre Mountains to continue the fight. By 1821, the Mexicans were prevailing over the Spanish, and Guerrero was hailed as an incorruptible independence fighter. In 1829, he became president of Mexico, and as William Lorne Katz writes in his book, Black Indians, he began a program of far-reaching reforms, abolishing the death penalty, and starting construction of schools and libraries for the poor. He ended slavery in Mexico. Yet because of his skin color, lack of education, and country manner, he was held in contempt by the upper classes in Mexico City. The great black historian J.A. Rogers considered Guerrero the George Washington and Abraham Lincoln of Mexico. Guerrero began his public life as an illiterate mule driver who got bit by the bug of the Mexican independence struggle. In that time of revolution, change, and transformation, a black man became president of the second largest country in North America. Today, 178 years later, we still wonder if such a thing is even possible. What does this say about the United States of America? From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
And you can listen to Mumia's audio commentaries at prisonradio.org. We turn now to our final story of the day. The United States is on the verge of losing one of its last military outposts in Latin America. Manta Airport in Ecuador is currently on a 10-year lease to the United States, signed in 1999. It's been used to combat the drug trade and immigration, as well as for counterinsurgency operations. When Ecuador's current president, Rafael Correa, was campaigning in 2006, he promised to make the contract renewal with the U.S. contingent on a reciprocal agreement, allowing Ecuador to build or station their military on an airbase in Miami. Predictably, the U.S. did not look too favorably on this. Manta Airport is expected to be leased to China instead. Meanwhile, Correa joined five other Latin American leaders last week in signing off on a joint development bank called the Bank of the South. The Bank of the South has been promoted by Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez to counter the influence of Western-dominated financial institutions like the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. My guest is Mark Becker. He is a Latin American historian, and he joins us on the line this morning. Welcome to Uprising, Mark.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. So it seems as though Ecuador and several other Latin American nations are trying to distance themselves, make themselves more independent, both militarily and financially, from the United States. Let's talk first about Manta Airport. What is this airbase specifically used for by the United States? I mentioned a few things in passing, but how has it been used so far?
Well, that's from the point of view of many people in Ecuador, that's it in a nutshell, is that it's being used to draw Ecuador into a conflict in Colombia, an internal conflict in Colombia. The United States justifies the airbase or the need for these what they call forward operating locations in order to intersect the drug trafficking in Colombia. And if we study the conflict in Colombia, we know that it's not about drug trafficking, it's about counterinsurgency. And increasingly, this conflict in Colombia is spilling over the borders into Ecuador. And from the point of view of most people in Ecuador, they have nothing to gain by becoming involved in what is a longstanding civil war in Colombia. So there's a variety of issues here. One is becoming involved in the issues in the foreign country. Another issue is this whole issue of imperialism, of nobody wants foreign troops on their soil.
What is behind allowing China into this airbase? Correa has talked about the Manta airbase as being a doorway for China into Latin America.
I don't know enough about that. And there's two things that come up with that. One is trying to diversify people's economy, so you're not just dependent on one country, which is the United States at this point. And the other is that for some people, China is a quickly growing economy, and so this becomes nothing other than a financial decision. And you're seeing some of this happening with Venezuela too, where Chavez is wanting to sell more and more oil, for example, to China. And some people initially said that, well, they want to sell the U.S.'s oil to China, and other people are saying, no, he just wants to sell more oil, and because China is a quickly growing economic powerhouse, it just makes sense to look there, that it's not really a political decision, it's an economic decision, and that might it might be nothing more than that here also.
Hmm. Now, Mark, what happened in to the investigation of the death of Guadalupe Lariva, the first female defense minister in Ecuador, who died in a helicopter crash in on Manta earlier this year? I understand she was quite vehemently against the U.S.'s presence in Ecuador militarily.
Yeah, and if there's been a conclusion in that study, I'm not aware of it. The last I heard is that the official line was that it was an accident. And personally, I have no reason to believe that it was other than an accident. And and so there's always these conspiracy theories that swirl around this, and part of this is it builds on in 1979 after a series of military dictators. I just blanked on his name. Rodos was the first civilian president, mm-hmm. who similarly died in an accident. And people have often pointed to the CIA as a culprit in that too. And so, in Ecuador, that this is how that played out. This is just a repeat of what happened to Rodos, who was similarly taking a position against United States imperialism. And in that case, neither it's like the Kennedy assassination or something like that. There's no conclusive evidence, and all of these theories swirl around. And in the end, I'm of the opinion that those are we have more serious political issues to deal with, mm-hmm. and that the current government is from the president, the foreign ministry, that they've all taken a strong stance against the Manta Air Force Base, and so. If indeed she was killed, the people who would want her dead, it's had a negative repercussion for them, because the government has moved, Rafael Correa's current government has just moved even more strongly in that direction of mm-hmm. evicting the airbase.
Mark, how does Manta Airbase fit within the larger context of U.S. military presence in Latin America? I mean, certainly, as you said, it has been used as a base for operations in Colombia and other neighboring countries. But are there other U.S. What other U.S. military bases are there in Latin American countries? And how important was Manta Airbase to the U.S. compared to other bases?
You know, on both accounts, frankly, we don't know. Because there's an international no bases organization that counts 1,000 foreign bases, not just talking about U.S. air bases in Latin America, but countries having air bases in other countries around the world, and saying that the lion's share, I forget what it is, something like 70% of those are U.S. bases, and the U.S. disputes those numbers, and part of it is what do you call an air base, and so there's like gray areas here, and so there's often multiple sides to this. In the U.S. claims that this airbase brings economic benefits to Manta. If you talk to U.S. soldiers who've been stationed there, they say that they love us. And locally in Manta, there is some support. And in many ways, that's not strange at all, because this is a common reaction to airbases. View that they bring economic benefits to the local community. And for decades, there have been studies that show that those economic benefits really are exaggerated. One study that I'm aware of is in the 70s, they closed an Air Force base in Saline, Kansas, and this was supposed to be a blow to the community. The community turned around and turned it into a refueling stop for air freight. And it turned out to economically be a benefit to the community to close the air base. And so people who study this issue say that the people who favor the air bases exaggerate their economic benefits. In terms of the political benefits, it's hard to really justify its use there, because the excuse is drug trafficking, but that's a bit of a poor excuse, like I was saying. And for me, what's more interesting is the response. And in March, there was an international conference in Ecuador against foreign military bases, and And the example that's always held up of how to close the airbase is at VA case in Puerto Rico, if you're familiar with that story.
Where right.
Since the 1940s, the U.S. was using it as a bombing range. And in terms of basic human rights, it's really quite a horrific story. And for decades, people there in VA case, increasingly people internationally, organized against this. And finally, on May 1st, 2003, forced the U.S. Navy to close their operations there, which led observers to, and this is always a problem with activism, is we have one march and we expect to win, and that's not the case. You need, like, sustained, ongoing energy coalition building, and that's what they achieved at VA case. And now I think here with Manta, it provides an alternative model for how to end the problem of these military bases, because this was a government decision
right.
rather than a popular decision. And for those of us who are watching Latin American politics, 10 years ago, people were saying, well, you can't make changes through state structures. And now, particularly with Hugo Chavez in the lead in Venezuela, we're really seeing a resurgence of belief in state structures in terms of making a better world for us. And the Ecuadorian government's decision to close the Manta Air Base, the U.S. presence there, is another example of how we are seeing the potential for governments to benefit us, the people, as opposed to corporations.
But these governments are backed by pretty strong social movements. I mean, they wouldn't have power if it weren't for their support among the populations, obviously.
Yeah, that's in Ecuador, that's a huge issue because, and we're really watching history in the making. They're in a constituent assembly right now, writing a new constitution. And we're anxiously watching to see how this plays out because, for example, indigenous movements are there in at the assembly putting forward their proposals.
Similar to what's just played out in Bolivia.
Yeah, yeah. Bolivia is more of a mess, and Ecuador has the potential of becoming as complicated as that. Because we always see is that the old wealth never gives up its power willingly.
Right. Finally, Mark, in the last couple of minutes of our interview, your thoughts on the Bank of the South as another step towards independence, particularly financial independence, that Ecuador and several other nations, in addition to Venezuela, signed on to. How promising is the Bank of the South as a real alternative to the IMF and the World Bank?
You know, this is the one place where I really have to trust Correa because he has a PhD in economics from the University of Illinois. He's a trained economist, and I think this is in one area which he really knows what he's doing. His dissertation was on three theses against neoliberalism, and this is in 1999, 2000, the Ecuador shifted their currency to the U.S. dollar, and that was a highly controversial. It led to the downfall of Jamil Wawat, the president then. And some people are saying, and this is the most interesting proposal I've seen come out of this, is the idea of a South American currency. And even then, people are saying our local currencies aren't strong enough to compete in a global economy. We need, like, a South American euro. And that's one thing now that this that Correa and people in this proposal are talking about is creating a South American common currency. And there's a lot of challenges here because Ecuador and Bolivia are small economies, and there's a threat that they'll be overwhelmed by Brazil, and so that the U.S.'s imperialism is replaced with the Brazilian economic domination, and so this is one thing that they're struggling with is how to build alternative economic models, and yeah, some people would question whether in the context of capitalism whether you can really build these types of economic models.
Well, Mark Becker, I want to thank you very much for joining us today and shedding some light on a lot of these issues that we don't really hear much about in the U.S. media.
Happy to be here.
Mark Becker, a Latin American historian, and we've been talking about Ecuador's decision to evict the U.S. from a base in Ecuador and, of course, the signing of an agreement towards the Bank of the South. For Sonali's subversive thought for the day, I'd like to quote Eduardo Galeano, who once said, "I'm astonished each time I come to the U.S. by the ignorance of a high percentage of the population, which knows almost nothing about Latin America or about the world. It's quite blind and deaf to anything that may happen outside the frontiers of the U.S. That's Eduardo Galeano, and that's Anali's Subversive Thought for the day. You've been listening to Uprising. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer. Today's show was directed by Ernesto Arce. Tamika Zogi is our engineer. You can hear an audio stream of today's program after 10 a.m. on our website, uprisingradio.org. Our email is mail@uprisingradio.org. CDs of the show are available at pacificaradioarchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening.